A little over 2 weeks ago, on Friday, March 15th, I received a text message from Nicholas Augusta, a guest on tonight's show. He informed me that Burl Burlingame, his co-star on tonight's show, had passed away suddenly at the age of 66. Just 1 week prior to receiving that text, I interviewed Burl for Vanished Amelia Earhart. You'll hear that interview tonight. Full disclosure, I didn't know Burl as well as many others did. But I did get to spend time with him talking about Hawaii's incredible connection to aviation and to Amelia Earhart. Everyone said I'd be impressed, and I was. Burl was an author, historian, and a writer. He was a storyteller, and he was really, really good at it. He was a newspaper man for 35 years, and he was also a curator and research specialist at the Pacific Aviation Museum Pearl Harbor, now known as the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum. And from what I could tell, he loved children. He loved passing on his immense amount of knowledge to the next generation. Part 7 of Vanished Amelia Earhart is bittersweet for me, and it's dedicated to the memory of Burl Burlingame. Tonight, Burl will tell you stories of Amelia Earhart in Hawaii, and you'll be captivated by those stories, as I was. And you'll understand why his passing is our loss. Say hello to Amelia and Fred for me, Burl. Blue skies and tailwinds. Now on with the show. This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, and thereafter. Although she was declared dead in absentia on January the 5th, 1939, there are many that believe the case of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan remains unsolved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. Spring has arrived, finally. It's been a long and brutal winter in Atchison, Kansas. The interesting thing about spring is that it signals a rebirth. Winter brings death. Spring brings that death back to life. And the birds chirp, which is always nice. 6 episodes down in this series, and tonight, things start to shift. When we last left her, Amelia Earhart had an idea. And that idea was to fly around the world at the equator. Because of her connection to Purdue University, she now had her vessel, a state-of-the-art Lockheed Electra 10E that was dubbed the Flying Laboratory. There are also a couple of characters that enter Amelia's life at this point, characters that will forever be etched into history alongside her, one especially. Tonight we discuss the first leg of her world flight and where that leg took her, Hawaii. All was well, spirits were up. And it seemed like Amelia Earhart was well on her way to adding World Flyer to her already huge list of career accomplishments. Then, shortly after 5:40 a.m., on the morning of March 20th, 1937, everything changed. On takeoff at Luke Field, Amelia Earhart ground-looped her aircraft. We'll talk a lot about that tonight. Pay close attention to the testimony throughout this episode. At the end, you decide. Did Amelia Earhart make a potentially fatal error on takeoff? Or was something else at play? Chasing Earhart may be wrapping up, but our investigation is just beginning. Time to go to work. It occurred to me that when I started this part of the investigation, I needed to reach out to people that aren't just experts in aviation and Amelia Earhart, but Hawaii aviation specifically. After all, this part of the story takes place there, So why wouldn't I pull all my sources and talk to people that know the story from the inside out? And boy, do I have the guest to get us started tonight. He's been waiting in the wings for a long time, and tonight, he's arrived.
So Amelia Earhart, you know, decides to fly the world, but she needs a crew. She needs some expertise, as this was no flight across the Atlantic, and it was certainly no flight across the Pacific from Honolulu to Oakland, as she did back in 1935.
Nicholas Augusta has a wide and varied background. He sold coffee for the world's leading coffee company, ventured into the retail and wireless industry, flown airplanes, managed restaurants, and has traded securities on Wall Street. He's a commercially rated pilot with a passion for aviation history in Hawaii and the Pacific. His first solo flight was from the very same runway on Ford Island where Amelia Earhart ground looped her Lockheed Electra. Currently, he's building a website, HawaiiAviation.org, where the history of aviation in Hawaiian islands can be shared. He's also the voice of Fred Noonan on Twitter, where he shares often in real time the events in 1937 and what it may have been like if Noonan himself was speaking. Amelia Earhart has a plan and a plane, and now she needs a crew. This was going to be by far her most incredible flight ever, but even Amelia knew she couldn't do it alone. She needed to put a team together.
This was around the world at the equator, a huge undertaking. So enter Harry Manning. So Amelia Earhart first met Harry Manning in 1928 when returning from England after her first flight across the Pacific aboard the Fokker F7, named the Friendship, where she was part of the crew, or as she put it, just a sack of potatoes. As she didn't really have any actual flying duties on the flight, she just basically helped out with planning the flight itself. So Manning was the captain of the SS President Roosevelt, the ship that returned Amelia and her fellow crew members of the Friendship back to the U.S. So while on board, Captain Manning struck up a friendship with Amelia, as they had mutual interests and had a great conversation about flying and adventure. Manning was the youngest captain of the United States Lines. He was a well-respected ship captain, qualified nautical navigator, proficient with radio, and was able to send and receive Morse code. He was also a licensed pilot, having obtained his license in 1930. When the time came to get a crew together, well, for the world flight, Manning was certainly at the top of the list.
Captain Harry Manning. As Nicholas just mentioned, Harry Manning was an American master mariner, aviator, and an officer in the United States Navy Reserve. He's most noted for his heroic role in the rescue of 32 crew members from Italian freighter Florida and for commanding the SS United States on her record-breaking maiden crossings of the Atlantic. He was among those honored in two ticker tape parades, the first in 1929 as a crew member of the America, and again in 1952 as master of the SS United States. He joined the United States Lines in 1922 and soon advanced up the officer ranks on the liners George Washington and Leviathan. He received his first command in 1927 as master of the President Roosevelt. I have to tell you that this was a man whose reputation was no joke. And he liked Amelia. He saw something in her. He believed in her.
Amelia asked him to join her project to fly the world, and Manning's employer, the United States Lions, granted his request for a 3-month leave of absence, and he was able to join the world flight. Manning's challenge, however, was that he was a nautical or maritime navigator. He was not adept at the new science of aerial navigation. He needed to be confident in using the appropriate tools and procedures for aerial navigation and be prepared to calculate his positions much quicker, as an airplane moves much faster than an ocean-going ship. On February 13, 1937, Manning, along with Amelia and her husband George Putnam, flew the Lockheed Electra 10E from New Jersey to Burbank, California. And en route, there was a problem. Manning made a mistake in his celestial navigation that caused both Amelia and her husband to really question his aerial navigation proficiency. Manning had them at one point over southern Kansas, when in fact they were over northern Oklahoma. And as Putnam stated, he didn't even have us in the right state. They were really concerned, as was Amelia's technical advisor, Paul Mantz. If he makes a mistake like that, how can he be expected to find Howland Island, a half square mile speck in the ocean, 1,700 miles from Honolulu? And as Amelia had said, it's much easier to hit a continent than it is an island. Well, this was the World Flight's first problem.
We're seeing where Harry Manning was both beneficial to the crew of the World Flight and maybe where he fell a bit short. Nautical navigation skills would be important to have on hand. However, this was a flight after all, and Amelia Earhart needed someone that had the ability to navigate the skies. She needed someone that was considered one of the very best to ever do it. Enter Frederick J. Noonan.
Fred Noonan came from a maritime background and had sailed across the oceans and really rose from the rank of an able-bodied seaman to that of captain of large ocean-going steamships. And in 1930, he obtained a commercial pilot's license and then joined Pan American Airways, where he taught aerial navigation and for a short time served as Pan Am's airport manager in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. He would later return to Miami when he then instructed Pan Am's senior pilots in the art or the fine art of aerial navigation for Pan Am's upcoming survey flights and for the eventual commercial passenger and mail service across the Pacific in 1935.
Fred Noonan was born in Cook County, Illinois. His parents were Joseph T. Noonan, born in Lincolnville, Maine in 1861, and Catherine Egan, born in London, England. The family was of Irish descent. Noonan's mother died when he was four, and 3 years later, a census report lists his father as living alone in a Chicago boarding house. Relatives or family friends were likely looking after Noonan. In his own words, Noonan, quote, left school in summer of 1905 and went to Seattle, Washington, end quote, where he found work as a seaman. At the age of 17, Noonan shipped out of Seattle as an ordinary seaman on a British sailing bark, the Crompton. Between 1910 and 1915, Noonan worked on over a dozen ships, rising to the ratings of quartermaster and bosun's mate. He continued working on merchant ships throughout World War I, serving as an officer on ammunition ships. His harrowing wartime service included being on three vessels that were sunk from under him by U-boats. After the war, Noonan continued in the Merchant Marines and achieved a measure of prominence as a ship's officer. Throughout the 20s, his maritime career was characterized by steadily increasing ratings and good, typically the highest, work performance reviews. Noonan married Josephine Sullivan in 1927 in Jackson, Mississippi. After a honeymoon in Cuba, they settled in New Orleans. Following a distinguished 22-year career at sea, which included sailing around Cape Horn seven times, three times under sail, Noonan contemplated a new career direction. After learning to fly in the late 1920s, he received a limited commercials pilot's license in 1930, on which he listed his occupation as aviator. In the following year, he was awarded Marine License number 121190, Class Master Any Ocean, the qualifications of a merchant ship captain. During the early 1930s, he worked for Pan American World Airways as a navigator instructor in Miami and an airport manager in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, eventually assuming the duties of inspector for all of the company's airports. 1937 was a year of transition for Noonan, whose reputation as an expert navigator, along with his role in the development of commercial airline navigation, had already earned him a place in aviation history. The tall, very thin, dark auburn-haired and blue-eyed 43-year-old navigator was living in Los Angeles. He resigned from Pan Am because he felt he had risen through the ranks as far as he could as a navigator, and he had an interest in starting a navigation school. In March, he divorced his wife, Josie. 2 weeks later, he married Mary Beatrice Martinelli of Oakland, California. Noonan was rumored to be a heavy drinker. That was a fairly common thing during this era, and there was no contemporary evidence Noonan was ever an alcoholic. Although decades later, a few writers and others made some hearsay claims that he was. Remember that last part. It's going to come back around later. Back to Nicholas.
With Noonan's work in helping pioneer Pan Am's Pacific routes, as well as being the navigator for the famous China Clipper that flew across the Pacific from Alameda, California to Manila, he really helped seal his outstanding reputation as an aerial navigator. Without doubt, Noonan was the most qualified person in aerial navigation in 1937. He was, as they say, the top of the pyramid.
Amelia now has Harry Manning, Fred Noonan, and her husband George Putnam, as always, by her side for the first leg of the world flight. Let's keep in mind here that the first leg, like most of the world flight, went off without a hitch. It's a flight Amelia had made before, and this time she's arriving in all her glory with her crew and her flying laboratory in tow.
Well, the flight from Oakland out to Hawaii, Amelia and her crew, they departed at 4:17 on the afternoon of March 17th, It was 2,800 miles to Honolulu and Wheeler Field. Paul Mantz was in the right seat and would handle the throttles and some of the flying duties while Manning worked the radios and navigated. Noonan, having navigated across the Pacific 12 times before with Pan American, also assisted with the navigation. For Noonan, really, it was old hat for him. So an hour out of Oakland, Amelia observed that something that she had never seen before, another aircraft in flight on a transoceanic flight. This was the Pan Am Clipper, and it was also bound for Honolulu, having taken off from Alameda. This was really the first time the Pan Am pilots flying the Pacific had also seen another aircraft in flight. It was, at the time, apparently quite a significant sight. You know, it's amazing when you think today, the hundreds of flights that cross the Pacific each and every day. In fact, there's a very cool photo of the Clipper in the Earhart Putnam collection at Purdue University taken from the Electra. You can see the Pan Am Sikorsky S-42 Clipper near a formation of cumulus clouds, and it's framed with the Electra's cockpit window. It's pretty cool.
And yes, in case you're wondering, we'll have that photo in tonight's show notes.
So the Electra continued on with the flight. It was pretty much uneventful, with the exception of the right engine's propeller governor, which failed and kept the propeller in a fixed pitch. This would clearly have to be addressed at Wheeler Field after they landed. At 5:45 in the morning on the 18th, they landed in the pre-dawn light at Wheeler, and 15 hours, 47 minutes to Honolulu. Again, there is some wonderful photos showing a smiling and glowing Amelia and her crew on arrival at Wheeler. Well, the first leg completed, a speed record on the route, and not bad for the first leg.
Not bad indeed. Setting records along the way to potentially setting the biggest record of all. Just another day in the cockpit for Amelia Earhart. You might have noticed Nicholas mentioned another character that was part of the World Flight crew, and he's one we haven't mentioned yet. He served as Amelia's technical advisor, and he would be an integral part of this leg of the world flight, as well as her time in Hawaii over the next couple of days.
Fortunately, Paul Mantz, a former Army Air Corps pilot, a Hollywood stunt pilot, and an outstanding aviator in his own right, had for several years as Amelia's technical advisor, including advising Amelia's first solo flight from Honolulu to Oakland in January 1935. Mantz was familiar with the techniques of Pan American Airways and their overwater transoceanic flying. They had several contacts amongst a very small and tight-knit community of the navigators at the time, and including Pan American's chief navigator, Fred Noonan. With the help of Putnam's contacts at the Bureau of Air Commerce, Earhart came into contact with Noonan.
Paul Mantz was born in Alameda, California, the son of a school principal, and was raised in nearby Redwood City, California. He developed his interest in flying at an early age. As a young boy, his first flight on fabricated canvas wings was aborted when his mother stopped him as he tried to launch off the branch of a tree in his yard. Sound familiar? In 1915, at age 12, he attended the Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco and witnessed the world-famous Lincoln Beachy make his first ever flight in his new monoplane, the Lincoln Beachy Special. Mantz took his first flying lesson at age 16, using money that he made from driving a hearse during the influenza epidemic of 1919. Although he had accumulated hours towards his private pilot certificate, Mantz quit flying altogether when he witnessed the death of his instructor. On September 24, 1924, Mantz became a part of a famous aviation event when he lent his car battery to the Douglas World Cruiser that had dead-sticked into a field on its way to San Francisco for a celebration of the world flight. He was invited to join the festivities at Crissy Field, where many noted military aviators tried to persuade him to pursue a career in military flying. Now, the first leg of their journey was behind them. Amelia's time in Hawaii for the world flight was upon her, but this wasn't all play. There was work to be done. As Nicholas mentioned, the flight over wasn't completely without incident, and the Electra needed some attention. In just a couple of short days, everything would change.
Having landed at the Army's Wheeler Field, there was really much to do. Earhart, Mantz, Noonan, and Manning headed into Waikiki to rest and really prepare for the next leg to Holland. Mantz, however, would later return to Wheeler Field that afternoon. First off, the propeller governor on the right engine needed to be addressed. And after repairs were made and an engine run up on the ramp by Mantz, the right propeller still wasn't working correctly. The Army facilities at Wheeler didn't have the equipment to address the problem. So both propellers were removed and trucked down to the Navy's Luke Field on Ford Island in the center of Pearl Harbor. The issue was eventually corrected overnight, and the propellers were brought back to Wheeler the following morning. The takeoff now for Holland would likely occur the following day in the afternoon of the 19th. Amelia promised that there would be no surprise takeoff like she did on her Honolulu-Oakland flight back in 1935. On that flight, she kept mum about it. Well, this flight would certainly be different. So at noon on the 19th, Mance took the Electra up on a short test flight and landed at Luke Field to have the final check of the Electra's engines. The decision was made that the departure from Hawaii to Holland would now be from Luke Field. It was just a much better runway environment there. You know, an interesting side note, too, is when Mance did the short 30-minute test flight to Luke Field, he had with him his fiancée and the owner of the house in Waikiki, where Amelia was staying. It certainly must have been a nice flight for those two passengers, for sure.
All systems go. This was it. They're getting ready for the most difficult leg of their journey, from Hawaii to Howland Island. That was the original plan. But as we all know, things don't always go according to plan.
So with the test flight, it really proved that there was no issues with the Electra, and it should be good for the takeoff to Holland, pending, obviously, the weather conditions. Mance ordered the Electra to be fueled and prepped for departure. However, the fuel being used from the Standard Oil truck was contaminated with sediment. Refueling was stopped, and at the request of Mance, fuel from the Air Corps was requested and ultimately used to fill the Electra's tanks. Earhart now pushed the departure to a dawn departure on the 20th, and she arrived in the morning at Luke Field at 4:30, along with Mance, Manning, and Noonan. Mance would not be continuing on the flight. He would be returning to Los Angeles with his fiancée to get married. Noonan would handle the navigation to Holland and then get off there, as he joined the world flight too late to acquire the necessary visas in the countries that were beyond Holland. Manning would continue on to Leh and Darwin, Australia, where he would then get off, and Amelia would continue around the world solo, with the most difficult part of the flying behind her.
One by one, like dominoes, Amelia's crew would leave the flight, leaving her alone to make history. The experts came together for various reasons to help Amelia Earhart accomplish something that had never been accomplished before. And when their time was up, they would exit the flight and move into the history books. But history would rewrite itself that morning, like it has so many times before.
So Mance performed his last checks on the Electra, did the engine run up, and at 5:30, Earhart, Manning, and Noonan boarded. Noonan taking the right seat, Manning taking the navigator's position in the rear of the Electra. Amelia started the engines up and immediately taxied to the north end of the runway for a departure to the south. Weather conditions were good and some overnight rain showers had dissipated. The winds were out of the south, less than 2 knots, and scattered clouds at about 3,000. Weather looked good. When Amelia got to the end of the runway, she opened the throttles of both her powerful 550 horsepower Pratt & Whitney Wasp engines and proceeded down the runway. As the Electra gathered speed at the 900-foot mark, it swung to the right. Amelia immediately throttled the left engine back, whereupon the Electra was now veering to the left. She was now entering what they call a ground loop. The right wing now low, with the weight of the Electra now fully on the right landing gear. The right-hand gear suddenly collapses, immediately followed by the left gear, and the Electra now skids with a shower of sparks towards the left side of the runway and immediately turns into a 200-degree heading from its initial course down the runway. Clearly, it was a very violent crash, and with both landing gears sheared off, the right wing and engine nacelle severely damaged, both props bent, the tail rudder and stabilizer bent and of course the oil and fuel tanks ruptured and now leaking. And fortunately for everyone involved, there was no fire. So Earhart and Noonan both emerged from the overhead cockpit door, and Manning exited out the rear of the aircraft. It was an absolute disaster, all in a matter of 30 seconds. And when we take a look at some of the photographs of the aftermath, we can just see how violent the crash was. There is one photo of Amelia and Fred standing up through the cockpit, cockpit door, and Amelia's face can only be described as really having the look of dread. Fortunately for the flyers, None of them were seriously hurt. They were very lucky. In one photo, we can see Manning on the left wing while Earhart gathers her things in the cockpit. We can only imagine what was going through his mind after being tossed about in the back of the plane. The photos are very telling as we see the dawn sky starting to fade away, and we see at this point very little of Earhart, Noonan, and Manning. They sort of disappeared off the scene rather quick. They left Ford Island, headed back to Honolulu. We do see Mance a lot, inspecting the crushed Lockheed Electra and directing its initial salvage. And when within 6 hours, all of them would be on the Matson liner, the SS Malolo, heading back to Los Angeles. Again, we can only imagine what's going through all of their minds while they're sailing towards Los Angeles and not in the air 6 hours into a flight towards Howland.
Let's stop there. Before we recorded, Nicholas was kind enough to provide me with the official accident report at Luke Field. Strap yourself in. This is a long one. The report reads as follows. Proceedings of a board of officers appointed to investigate and report upon the crash of Miss Amelia Earhart's airplane in R-16020 at Luke Field, Oahu, at 5:50 a.m., March 20th, 1937, and circumstances relating to her arrival and stay at Wheeler and Luke Fields, March 18 to 20, 1937. Personnel for the board are as follows. Major Phillips Melville, Air Corps President, Luke Field. First Lieutenant Kenneth A. Rogers, Air Corps Member, Wheeler Field. First Lieutenant Harry S. Bishop, Air Corps Member, Luke Field. Second Lieutenant Norman L. Kalish, Air Reserve Recorder, Luke Field. This board comprises the Standing Accident Classification Committee, Luke Field, with the addition of one member from Wheeler Field appointed per oral order of the Commanding General, 18th Composite Wing. Oral instructions to the board were to investigate and render a detailed confidential report on the circumstances of the crash of Miss Earhart's Lockheed Electra airplane at Luke Field on the morning of March 20, 1937, including for record an account of the preparation made for her arrival at Wheeler Field, her stay at that post, the transfer of her airplane to Luke Field, preparations for her takeoff for Howland Island, and a detailed report of all services rendered by the personnel of either post and the Hawaiian Air Depot from the date of arrival until the airplane was shipped aboard the SS Lurline, March 27, 1937. Regarding the events of the morning of March 20th, 1937, the report reads in part, at 3:45 a.m., the airplane was placed on the apron, the area roped off, and a heavy guard established. Traffic to the Fleet Air Base was halted, except for Navy personnel. Miss Earhart and party reached Luke Field via the Fleet Air Base at 4:30 a.m., on arrival, Mr. Mance requested 75 additional gallons of gasoline, which were serviced, making a total of 590 gallons at Air Corps gasoline, furnished, and a total of 900 gallons according to a statement made by Miss Earhart. At 4:45 a.m., a number of press representatives arrived via the Navy. Due to the fact that the Luke Field Ferry does not commence operations until 6:15 a.m., there were no casual visitors or sightseers. At 5 a.m., Mr. Mance thoroughly inspected the airplane, including the tires, warmed up the engines, and then shut them off. Miss Earhart then took her place in the pilot's cockpit, and at her request, the southwest floodlights were turned on for a short period to permit her to survey the runway. She decided to delay takeoff until there was sufficient daylight to see clearly. At 5:30 a.m., Captain Manning and Mr. Noonan boarded the airplane, and Miss Earhart started the motors. At 5:40, she taxied slowly to the northeast end of the runway, accompanied by the Luke Field fire truck, also termed the crash truck. Members of the work detail of the Hawaiian Air Depot stationed themselves at intervals along the west side of the runway. A special guard of enlisted men had previously been stationed at 200-foot intervals between the hangar line and the runway for the dual purpose of keeping the mat clear and to check the point at which the airplane left the ground. As Miss Earhart taxied down the mat, a Navy Grumman airplane taxied out from the Navy side and, in spite of efforts by a naval officer to wave him down, followed her to the end of the runway and parked off the mat out of her way. Flying conditions at this time were good. Ceiling about 3,000 feet. Wind southerly, not exceeding 2 miles per hour. Visibility at the surface about 3,500 feet, rapidly increasing with advancing daylight. On reaching the end, Miss Earhart turned and, after a brief delay, opened both throttles. As the airplane gathered speed, it swung slightly to the right. Miss Earhart corrected this tendency by throttling the left-hand motor. The airplane then began to swing to the left with increasing speed, characteristic of a ground loop. It tilted outward, right wing low, and for 50 or 60 feet was supported on the right wheel only. The right-hand landing gear suddenly collapsed under the excessive load followed by the left. The airplane spun sharply to the left, sliding on its belly, and amid a shower of sparks from the mat, came to rest headed about 200 degrees from its initial course. The fire truck had followed along the side of the mat during the takeoff and reached the scene within a few seconds, as did the observers nearest the crash. There was no fire. Miss Earhart and her crew emerged unhurt. The visible damage to the airplane was as follows. Right wing and engine severely damaged. Left engine damaged on underside. Right hand rudder and end of stabilizer bent. Minor damage to the underside of the fuselage. Both propellers bent. The engines were undamaged. The oil tanks ruptured. The damaged airplane was roped off under guard as promptly as possible by the officer of the day. All authorized persons were cleared from the mat, and the work of salvage initiated by the depot engineering officer occurred without delay. The greater part of the gasoline was first pumped from the tanks into a refueling truck. Depot personnel then commenced to disassemble the airplane, preparatory to removing it from the mat. All loose property of technical or personal nature was collected under the supervision of an officer and placed for safekeeping in a stockroom at the depot. The work of removing the damaged airplane was continued in spite of steady rains and was completed by 6 p.m., at which time the airplane was housed in the final assembly hangar pending disposition. At 9 a.m., Mr. Emil Williams, Department of Commerce Inspector, arrived at Luke Field for the purpose of investigating the crash. By order of the wing commander, he was accorded every assistance and permitted to interview and take statements from witnesses. On March 25, the commanding officer, Hawaiian Air Depot, issued orders that the work of disassembly be continued and the airplane prepared for shipment to California. This work was completed March 26, and the airplane delivered to the representative of the Young Brothers Company for transfer by barge to Honolulu. It was shipped, addressed to Miss Amelia Earhart, Burbank, California, aboard the SS Lurline, which sailed for San Francisco at noon, March 27th, 1937. The board finds that Miss Amelia Earhart with Mr. Paul Mance, technical advisor, Captain Harry Manning, and Fred Noonan landed a Lockheed Electra airplane, NR-16020, at Wheeler Field, Oahu, at 5:45 a.m., March 18, 1937. That adequate preparations had been made for her arrival by the commanding officer, Wheeler Field. That the personnel of the station engineering department under competent supervision carried out a thorough check of the airplane and engines, that a dangerous condition of the propellers was discovered and remedied at the Hawaiian Air Depot, that subsequently the propellers functioned perfectly, that the airplane was flown to Luke Field at noon March 19, 1937, that at this time it was announced by Mr. Mance, technical advisor for Miss Earhart, that she would take off from Luke Field as the mat afforded better conditions than Wheeler Field, that during the afternoon, 515 gallons of Air Corps gasoline were serviced into the airplane at the request of Mr. Mance and on the authority of Lieutenant Colonel Hume Peabody, Operations Officer, 18th Composite Wing, that this was later increased to 590 gallons, making a total gasoline load of 900 gallons according to statement by Miss Earhart, that at about 9 p.m. March 19th, Luke Field was notified that the takeoff would be made at dawn, that Miss Earhart and party reached Luke Field at 4:30 a.m., March 20, 1937, and that the airplane, including the tires, was inspected by Mr. Mance shortly thereafter, that Miss Earhart with Captain Manning and Mr. Noonan as crew taxied out for a takeoff at 5:30 a.m., that a takeoff was made from northeast to southwest, that after a run of approximately 1,200 feet, the airplane crashed on the landing mat due to a collapse of the landing gear as a result of an uncontrolled ground loop, that lack of factual evidence makes it impossible to establish the reason for the ground loop, that as a result of the crash, the airplane was damaged to an extent requiring major overhaul, that no injuries were suffered by Miss Earhart or her crew, that approximately 50 square feet of the Luke Field landing mat was damaged, necessitating replacement, that no other damage was sustained by government or private property. The board finds further that every reasonable facility and service requested by Miss Earhart or her representative, Mr. Paul Mance, was accorded by the Station Engineering Department, Wheeler Field, and by the Hawaii Aviation Air Depot, that no requests were refused, that Miss Earhart's technical advisor, Mr. Paul Mance, landed the airplane on the mat at Luke Field about noon, March 19, 1937, at which time he inspected it and pronounced it suitable for her takeoff for Howland Island, that her decision to use it was based on his recommendation and his recommendation alone, and that the nature and condition of the Luke Field landing mat had no bearing on the causes resulting in the crash, that in a signed statement to the press, Ms. Earhart stated, quote, "The runway is excellent and every facility for safe flying available," end quote. That subsequent to the crash, prompt and efficient action was taken by the engineering officer, Hawaiian Air Depot, to remove the damaged airplane from the runway and to safeguard it and the technical and personal property it contained, that it was subsequently shipped to Ms. Amelia Earhart, Burbank, California, on board the SS Lurline, sailing from Honolulu, Hawaii, March 27, 1937, in compliance with orders of competent authority based on the written request and authorization of Miss Earhart. It is the conclusion of the board that every reasonable assistance and facility was accorded Miss Earhart by the 18th Composite Wing to facilitate her flight, and that no claim of negligence or responsibility in connection with her crash can be sustained against the personnel, equipment, or facilities made available to Miss Earhart by the Commanding General Aviation Department. Recommendations, none. Phillips Melville, Major Air Corps President, Department Air Office. There have been many ideas, suggestions, and theories as to what exactly happened that morning. In reading the official report and talking to Nicholas, one can conclude that maybe Amelia Earhart simply made a mistake. It happens. But was it a fatal one? This incident forced the postponement of the rest of the world flight until the Electra could be properly put back together again. More importantly, though, this incident forced a change in direction for the flight, bringing the aviators west to east instead of east to west. Did that ground loop essentially seal the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan? As I spoke with Nicholas, he informed me of another incident, this time attributed to navigator Fred Noonan, that I hadn't previously known about. And it may be a potentially telling piece of information when it comes to the aviators eventually flying to and locating Howland Island.
On a flight aboard one of Pan Am's Clippers in 1936, while flying from Midway Island to Wake Island, the Pan Am team on Wake Island radioed the approaching Clipper that, based on their direction-finding equipment, the inbound Clipper was 200 miles south of course, passing Wake Island. Captain Music, who was Pan Am's chief pilot, who had flown many times with Noonan, asked Noonan if this was correct, and Noonan said, no, it wasn't. Just continue on for another 20 minutes, and we should sight Wake Island just ahead. Well, Music responded that we are not flying another 20 minutes. We are turning north now. And indeed, after turning north, Wake Island appeared after a short time. And upon landing at Wake, Captain Music told Noonan that he had better bone up on his navigation. And I think, you know, this is important, as it really reminds us that aerial navigation can fail. It can fail due to many things, including human error. It reminds us all that these flyers and navigators in the 1930s were doing something dangerous and very unforgiving if mistakes were made. You know, it's today, we call it the human factor, that often plays a significant role in aircraft accidents, and we see this to this day.
I often wonder about this question. You've probably heard me ask it on the Chasing Earhart podcast quite a few times. If Amelia Earhart successfully had taken off from Luke Field that morning, are we even discussing this world flight in the same context 82 years later? Was that one mistake really the key, or would the result have been the same, only much sooner in the flight?
Did the ground loop have a direct impact? I would say, yeah, it certainly did, because it changed the dynamic of the flight. Obviously, the crew members were going to change at Howland and at Darwin when Manning was to get off, and then Amelia was going to go solo the rest of the way. But it's interesting that Noonan and Earhart flew it around the world together with really no problems all the way up to approaching Howland. So, yeah, it definitely changed the outcome of the flight. It's kind of a sad thing. You know, you just wonder what would happen if they had reached Howland and then continued on. Would Amelia have done it? I think she would have. I think historically, we would have seen Amelia complete her round-the-world flight. You know, on the voyage back to the West Coast on the Malolo, I'm sure there was some soul-searching by all of them on board. Or is it just the fact that Manning's leave was coming up and the repairs to the Electra would take too long and he'd have to return to the United States lines? I know Time Magazine, in an article about Manning, stated that by his own admission, he was a stubborn, bullheaded, tactless introvert and an unsmiling perfectionist with a passion to run a perfect ship. So one can possibly guess that by looking at the newsreels too, of his photos of Manning arriving in Los Angeles that maybe he did not want to have anything to do with this around-the-world flight. You take a look at the photos and the newsreels themselves, and his demeanor is one that's like, I can't believe I'm involved with this mess. He almost looks uninterested.
After learning about the ground loop from Nicholas and reading the accident report, I felt a little down, and I didn't want all of you to feel the same way. I didn't want you to feel that Amelia's legacy in Hawaii was the ground loop. Sure, it was a big deal, but Amelia's Hawaiian history went far beyond that one trip. In preparing for this part of the series, I reached out to various contacts that I've made in Chasing Earhart, and everyone recommended the same guy. When Nicholas recommended him, I knew I was on the right track.
Well, Hawaii is one of the most remote inhabited places on Earth. Mark Twain called it a necklace of islands. And so aviation basically helped unify the islands with the rest of the world. So aviation was really important to Hawaii. Their first planes came out here on New Year's Eve, 1911, and have been here ever since.
Burl Burlingame is the very definition of a historian. An author, newspaper man, and former curator, Burl has more knowledge on Hawaiian aviation than anyone I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with. He's the kind of expert that experts recommend you talk to when they don't have the answers you're looking for. And he's a master storyteller. I hope you see that.
Well, in early 1935, she pulled sort of a trick on Hawaii. She came out here with her husband and her mentor, Paul Mance, and brought her what she called her red bus, Lockheed. Said basically she was here on a to do tours and she wanted to flivver around the islands in her red bus. And then she did a lot of tourist stuff, a lot of real high visibility tourist stuff, flying to the neighbor islands, visiting hula troops, planting a tree on the, in Hilo, which is still standing, by the way, with her name in front of it. While this was going on, Paul Mance was preparing the airplane. And then one evening she took off and didn't report in until she was more than halfway to California, beyond the no return point. They did not tell anyone that she was becoming the first solo flight between Hawaii and the mainland. Not the first woman, but the first person to make a solo flight between Hawaii and the mainland. And she aimed from Hawaii to the mainland because the target's bigger. But she flew from here to the Bay Area and was only a couple miles off course and landed at Oakland Field.
What a great story. Amelia played a little trick on Hawaii. I learn something new each time we record. What I find interesting about that story is that Amelia kept a secret about a flight she was making. So she was capable of doing that. Am I reading too much into that? Maybe. Moving on.
She had been involved in a few crashes in the past, and I think they were afraid of her having to turn back because of some mechanical failure. When she was short of the no return mark, and so they kept it under wraps, and of course it was a stunt in some ways. I mean, you could a lot of male pilots, MALE pilots, derided her abilities, but none of them could match her instinct for publicity, and. By the time she landed in Oakland, there were thousands of people very excited to see her land. Caused a tremendous wave of excitement, and people flooded the airfield in Oakland.
Interestingly enough, Amelia wasn't the only one on the World Flight crew that had a history with Hawaii. Paul Mance and Harry Manning had been through the islands on numerous occasions, and Pan Am, Fred Noonan's company, spent time perfecting aerial navigation there. As Burl explains it, Hawaii has deep roots in multiple facets of Amelia Earhart's life and inner professional circle.
Manning had been in and out as a ship navigator, and his skills were in ship navigation. And Mance, as a aviation professional, he certainly had been in and out, but he certainly passed through here several times. Pan Am did the pioneering flights. Interestingly, on her solo flight, Earhart spotted one of the Pan Am passenger planes en route and photographed it, and she overtook it and passed it. The thing is that aerial navigation, particularly on great circle routes, was something that was really a new science. And these were the guys who were pioneering it. And it was all being invented as they went along. And that's one of the things Pan Am was pioneering and doing. And the guys who knew how to do it were a very small circle, and they all knew each other.
How would you have liked to be in that inner circle? Earlier, we got Nicholas's take on how Hawaii ties into the world flight and the ground loop incident in particular. But I wanted to ask Burrell for his take on that day. After all, every expert you talk to perhaps can give you a different piece of the puzzle or a different perspective, and that's what this investigation is all about.
The original idea was to fly around the world as close to the equator as possible, which was the around-the-world flight that had not been done yet. And she was determined to break that record. And at that time of year, which was March 1937, weather conditions dictated that they go around the world in a clockwise direction. And so they took off from Oakland and flew to Hawaii. And actually, they took off from Oakland in rainy conditions, fully loaded, with four people on the airplane, two navigators, Mance and Earhart, and off a rainy field in Oakland. Flew successfully, landed at Wheeler, started servicing the airplane. They had problems with the propeller icing up at altitude. And Mance asked the Army to service the propellers. One of the interesting things about the flight is how much help they got from the military without going through Washington.
Light bulb. Did you hear that? Quote, what's interesting is how much help they got from the military without going through Washington, end quote. I sat right up when I heard that.
The military always happy to help, and they took the propellers off. They took them down to the propeller shops on Ford Island, and the Army technicians got them in shape and put them back on the airplane. Mance test flew it, said it was fine. They moved the airplane down to Ford Island, to Luke Field, and prepared it for takeoff there. All this was done pretty quickly. Basically, they were here only about 36 hours. The local commanders had a lot more autonomy at the time, simply because it took longer to get okays from Washington. And it's always better to beg forgiveness than to, you know, be turned down. There's a famous picture of the Electra being fueled at Oakland Field, and Mance is standing on the wing, and the sailors are fueling the airplane. And it's raining. It's obviously raining, but they are filtering the fuel as it's loaded in the plane. And Mance was a real stickler for fuel quality. And when the plane was moved down to Luke Field, they checked the filters, started loading it up with fuel from a civilian fuel truck. And the filters were showing particles of metal. So Mance refused the fuel, asked for a new load of fuel. And the civilian fuel truck was switched with another civilian fuel truck. It also had metal particles. And so Mance asked for all military fuel. And the Army Air Corps said no problem and completely fueled the plane with Army fuel.
I'm liking Paul Mance more and more by the second. If I'm flying around the world, I want him to be my technical advisor. Military fuel. I hope you're taking notes. Back to March 20th.
The conditions were very similar between there and Oakland. It was a rainy morning. It was dark. The runway on Luke Field was crushed coral soaked with oil to make it dense. Oakland Field was cement, which made it harder. There were no lights on the field. The Navy and the Army shared Luke Field. Actually, the Army version was Luke Field. The Navy version was Naval Air Station Pearl Harbor. For example, they were preparing for the flight, and a Navy airplane started up and waddled right in the path of the Earhart's airplane, and they had to wave it off because no one had told the Navy this was happening. A lot of onlookers showed up, and they realized they couldn't see the edges of the runway. So they handed everyone flashlights and asked them to line up on the edges of the runway about 100 feet apart, which didn't illuminate the runway, but she could at least tell where the edges of the runway were. Remember, this was a pre-dawn takeoff. And about 5:45 a.m., Mance started the plane up about 5 a.m., got it running. She took over and started takeoff about 5:45 a.m. It went down the runway, and apparently the one wing lifted higher than the other, and she over-controlled somehow, apparently by throttle, according to the official report. And the wing slammed down, which made the tire burst. The landing gear dug into the ground, plane spun around, breaking the other landing gear, and that was it.
What I was really curious about here was the toll this accident had on Amelia and the crew. Nicholas alluded to it before, but for Amelia, this was a failure on another level, on a world stage. And I wondered how that affected her mentally.
You know, she'd been in accidents before. Luckily, it happened in civilization, as it were. They were able to get on an ocean liner within an hour or so and get back to the United States and start planning. They also asked the Army to disassemble the airplane, clean it up, disassemble it, ship it back. And the Army went, okay, no problem, which is interesting also. And this airplane was in the middle of the field, an operating field, with fuel soaking in. Every picture you see of guys working on the airplane, there's guys standing around with fire extinguishers. The plane was damaged, but not severely so. The damage was primarily in the landing gear and the engine nacelles, some twisting of the wings. One of the things I understand, but I'm not absolutely sure on, is that the specifications for her flight, for the technical specifications for that airplane, are based on the pre-crash specs for the airplane. After the airplane was repaired and, you know, put back into service, it was not retested for speed and distance. So the specs may have been off.
Even after his passing, he's still taking me to school. What Burl just said should be alarming to you. If you're not following, let me fill you in. The original build for the Electra, as Amelia received it from Purdue, was tested thoroughly for speed and distance. Those factors were crucial to the success of the world flight. However, the version of the Electra that was received after it was rebuilt was not tested. That was the version Amelia and Fred would take around the world. It wasn't tested. Therefore, it wasn't 100% that this version of the plane could endure what the original version could. Really think about that. In the end, Amelia's time and impact in Hawaii is like it is everywhere. It looms over the island, and the monuments to her legacy are found all around.
Well, there is a monument to her that was created by the local chapter of the 99s. And it's over near Diamond Head, it was the last place people were able to see her airplane as it flew away on its way to the mainland in the 1935 flight. And it's a nice monument, and it's interesting. It shows the airplane high above the waves. The plaque is bronze, and it's fairly corroded, but the metal around the airplane is bright from people touching it. There is a time capsule buried in the monument, but the city has not decided to open it yet.
Before I hung up with Burl, he told me one more story, one that I'd like to leave you with tonight.
I had I was a newspaper man for a long time, and I had a coworker at the newspaper who was an older woman who was probably the best writer I've ever met. And when she was a little girl, she met Amelia Earhart at an air show on the mainland. And Amelia Earhart bent down and looked at her in the face and told her she could be anything she wanted to be. And this woman said she just never, ever forgot that for the rest of her life. There are people who make other people simply feel like they can do more just by the power of who they are. Earhart was like that. I mean, she may not have been the world's greatest pilot, but she was one of those people who made aviation what it is today.
And with that, my time with Burl was over. Little did I know that I'd be publishing his last work before his untimely passing. It goes to show you how fragile all of this really is. But Burl would want us to continue, so that's what we're going to do. Our time in Hawaii is over, and now, armed with all of the knowledge and the history, we're ready to take on the biggest historical mystery of all time. And we're going to do it in a way that you've never experienced before. 2 weeks from tonight, jury selection for the trial of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan begins. This is the trial of the century, and all of you are involved now.
This is Sean Palmer from the Doc Doc Goose podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished Amelia Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media where our team posts all of our episodes as they air, news and show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/vanishedAmeliaEarhart and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @vanishedAE. Reviews are crucial to the show, so if you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. It really helps us get the word out. Vanished Amelia Earhart is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Chris Williamson. Podcast music is provided by Dangerous Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished Amelia Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evans Films Incorporated. Chris Evans Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education and no infringement is intended. Vanished Amelia Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evans Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evans Films Incorporated, all rights reserved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is a Chris Evans Films production, copyright 2019, all rights reserved.